Good morning, and welcome to Simply Economics. It's Monday, April 29th. On today's show, an economist explains the economics of timeshare, and we take a look at the continued economic growth in the state's agriculture sector. Plus, we debunk the myth that a strong currency always means a strong economy. This coverage and more, up next. I'm David, and you're listening to Simply Economics. We start off with a leading economist sharing his insights into the financial merits of timeshares after attending a sales presentation in South Carolina. Arnold Kling, who has a PhD in economics from MIT and previously served as chief economist for the Federal Reserve Board, says the timeshare deal he was pitched was a losing proposition. Michael, what exactly did Kling find problematic with the timeshare offer?
Well, David, Kling applied a simple economic formula to determine if buying the timeshare made financial sense compared to just renting a vacation property. His profitability equation looks at the rental rate plus the appreciation rate minus the interest cost. If the result is positive, buying is the better option. If it's negative, renting makes more financial sense.
And in the case of this particular timeshare pitch, Kling determined it was not a good deal, correct? Even as the salesman tried to simplify the concept for him with drawings?
That's right. The timeshare salesman even resorted to drawing a picture of a trash can to illustrate where Kling's rental money was going, apparently not realizing he was dealing with a field-leading economist. Kling found the scenario quite amusing. But getting back to the economics, owning a vacation property can be advantageous if it appreciates in value over time. However, with a timeshare, you're not truly buying the unit itself. It's more of a membership to use the property for a set time each year.
So, the decision of whether to rent or buy ultimately depends on a variety of economic factors then, not just the basic notion that owning is always better than renting.
Exactly. As Kling puts it, if you had to pay an exorbitant amount, say $500,000, to buy something you could rent for just a nickel a year, buying wouldn't make much financial sense. The profitability formula takes into account the purchase price, rental rates, appreciation potential, and other key variables to determine if renting or buying is the optimal choice in a given scenario. Blanket statements that buying a timeshare is always a smart financial move don't hold up to economic scrutiny.
Very interesting insights. It seems that timeshare pitches often gloss over these important economic considerations. Thank you, Michael, for breaking this down for us. This has been Simply Economics, with a lesson from economist Arnold Kling on how to critically evaluate a timeshare offer. Something for our viewers to keep in mind as we head into the summer travel season. Speaking of economic development, the West Virginia Department of Agriculture is working to boost food production, maintain natural resources, and create jobs in the state. Agriculture Commissioner Kent Leonhardt says they have utilized abandoned mine lands to establish businesses like Buzz Foods in Charleston, which operates the Appalachian Abattoir and distributes locally produced meats. Another company, Appalachian Botanicals, grows lavender on former mine lands to make various products. For more on these efforts, we're joined by our Simply Economics correspondent. What can you tell us about some of the other agriculture-related businesses taking root in West Virginia?
One notable example is Morgantown-based Mountaintop Beverage, which moved into a 330,000-square-foot facility last year that now employs over 200 people. The company produces shelf-stable dairy products. CEO Jeff Sokol says while the location provides good access to markets and raw materials, it's really the dedicated and talented local workforce that has made their startup process relatively smooth. He emphasizes providing careers, not just jobs, is important to them.
Commissioner Leonhardt sees these types of businesses as key to sustaining farms and industry in the state while providing good wages and a stable tax base. He notes that agricultural manufacturing tends to be recession-proof. How has the state worked to support the growth of Mountaintop Beverage and attract additional economic development?
Part of the agreement to bring Mountaintop Beverage to the Morgantown Industrial Park included adding direct interstate access to keep truck traffic off local streets. When that project encountered federal delays, the state stepped up to fund a new bridge over the Monongahela River as an interim solution until an I-79 exit can be built, which is expected by 2027. So Carl says this improved access is already generating interest from other large businesses looking to locate in the industrial park, which will drive further job creation.
It's great to see West Virginia making strides in supporting local agriculture and creating new opportunities. Now let's shift our focus to another economic topic. A strong currency is often seen as a sign of a nation's economic prowess, but is that perception always accurate? Here to discuss this is our Simply Economics correspondent. So tell us, why might a strong currency not necessarily reflect a healthy economy?
Well, David, it's a common misconception to equate a strong currency with a thriving economy. Just like judging someone's character by their appearance can be misleading, relying solely on currency strength doesn't paint the full economic picture. Factors like GDP, export competitiveness, and economic diversity are crucial to truly assess a country's prosperity and stability.
Interesting. Can you explain how a strong currency might actually hurt a nation's exports and economic growth?
Absolutely. When a nation's currency appreciates relative to others, especially the U.S. dollar, its exports become more expensive for foreign buyers. This leads to reduced export volumes and revenues, potentially harming key industries, global competitiveness, and overall economic growth. It's a downside of currency strength that's often overlooked.
So if we can't rely on currency value alone, what other factors should economists and analysts consider to gauge a country's economic health?
There are several important indicators beyond currency strength. GDP growth, employment levels, inflation rates, and trade balances provide a more comprehensive view. Additionally, the diversity and resilience of an economy, its ability to weather external shocks like commodity price fluctuations or global trade shifts, are key considerations. Focusing too narrowly on currency appreciation can mask underlying vulnerabilities.
Thanks for that insightful analysis on assessing economic prowess. And speaking of economic policy, the Indian National Congress Party recently released its manifesto for the 2024 elections, and it contains a surprising declaration. The manifesto states it is time for a reset after 33 years, implying a major shift away from the transformative 1991 economic reforms ushered in by then Prime Minister Narasimha Rao and Finance Minister Manmohan Singh. For more on this, we're joined by our economics correspondent. What do you make of this call for an economic reset by the Congress Party?
This is indeed a bombshell announcement by the Congress, considering the 1991 reforms fundamentally changed India's economic trajectory for the better. Those reforms, initiated by Rao and Singh, opened up the economy, dismantled the license Raj, encouraged private enterprise, and made India more competitive globally. As a result, India saw accelerated growth, rising incomes, and a burgeoning middle class in the decades since. For the Congress to now imply those reforms were somehow inadequate or misdirected is quite shocking.
The manifesto talks about a new focus on work, wealth, welfare. How does that contrast with the post-1991 direction of the economy?
The emphasis on wealth redistribution and welfare in the Congress manifesto seems to hark back to the pre-reform era of state control and populist sops. It appears influenced by Rahul Gandhi's recent rhetoric around inequality and his talk of a revolution. This is worrying because prior to 1991, similar socialist policies had led to anemic growth, high poverty, and a stagnant economy. India was in an economic crisis when Rao and Singh took bold corrective steps. To go back to that model now would be regressive and undo a lot of the progress made.
But hasn't inequality worsened in the post-reform period? Is there perhaps some merit to Rahul Gandhi's critique?
While inequality has risen as the economy has grown rapidly, the reforms lifted tens of millions out of poverty and created a large middle class. Growth has slowed in recent years, but the answer lies in more reforms to boost competitiveness and ease of doing business, not in a return to unsuccessful past policies. Rahul Gandhi's prescriptions around price controls, higher subsidies, and guaranteed incomes would balloon the deficit and hurt long-term growth without really solving inequality. The Congress seems to be disowning its own legacy of Manmohanomics in pursuit of Rahul's Robin Hood economics.
It will definitely be interesting to see how this pivot by Congress is received by voters and impacts the economic discourse in the run-up to the 2024 elections. Thanks for your insights, Bella. And with that, we wrap up our stories for today. Thanks for listening to Simply Economics. We'll see you back here tomorrow.